Imagine you are a merchant living in a small city somewhere in what is now the country of Syria. Around the year 720 BCE, your city has walls, guards, and a king who has ruled peacefully for many years. Then one morning, a traveler arrives from the east with a pale face and shaking hands. He tells you a story. He says that 3 weeks ago, he watched an army unlike anything he had ever seen approach a city just like yours. Within days, that city's walls had crumbled. The people inside had been marched away in chains. The king had been killed, and now that army was moving west toward you. The army he is describing belongs to the Assyrians, and the terror on that traveler's face is not an accident. It is part of a plan. The Assyrian Empire is one of the most remarkable and most frightening stories in all of ancient history. For roughly 300 years, from around 934 BCE to 609 BCE, this empire dominated the ancient Near East. The Near East is the region we now call the Middle East, covering modern countries like Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Israel, and Egypt. At its greatest size, the Assyrian Empire stretched from the mountains of Iran in the east all the way to the banks of the River Nile in Egypt in the west. This was an extraordinary achievement for a people who began as a relatively small kingdom in what is today northern Iraq. But how did they do it? How did this one kingdom come to control so much of the ancient world? The answer is not simple luck or geography. The answer is a combination of brilliant military thinking, technological progress, terrifying methods of control, and a completely new way of organizing a large empire. Let us walk through each of these things carefully, because each one is a story in itself. To begin, we need to understand the world the Assyrians were born into. Mesopotamia is a Greek word that means the land between the rivers. It refers to the region between two great rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, which flow through modern Iraq. This land was the birthplace of some of the earliest cities and civilizations on Earth. Long before the Assyrians rose to power, great kingdoms had already risen and fallen here. Babylon was here. The Sumerians were here. The whole region was rich, contested, and dangerous. Growing up in such an environment, surrounded by competing powers, the Assyrians learned early that survival required strength. Assyrian history is divided by scholars into three main phases. The earliest phase, called the Old Assyrian Kingdom, lasted from roughly 2025 to 1378 BCE. The middle phase, the Middle Assyrian Empire, covered roughly 1392 to 934 BCE, but it is the third phase, called the Neo-Assyrian Empire, meaning the New Assyrian Empire, that concerns us most. This is the period from 934 to 609 BCE, the period when Assyria became the most powerful state on Earth. Think of the Neo-Assyrian period as the moment when a talented student who has spent years quietly learning suddenly stands up and begins to outperform everyone else in the room. The foundations were laid in the earlier periods, but the explosion of power came in this final era, driven by ambitious kings who were willing to completely rethink how a state and an army should work. The single most important of these reforming kings was a man named Tiglath-Pileser-Roman III, who ruled from 745 to 727 BCE. When he came to power, the Assyrian kingdom was actually in trouble. It was burdened by weak administration, rebellious provinces, and military problems. Tiglath-Pileser looked at this mess and did something bold. He rebuilt nearly everything from the ground up. His most revolutionary act was creating the world's first known professional standing army. To understand why this was so revolutionary, you need to know how armies worked before this. In most kingdoms of the ancient world, if a king wanted to go to war, he would send out a call to his farmers and craftsmen. These men would leave their fields and workshops, pick up weapons, march to war, and then, when the campaign was over, go home again. This kind of army is called a levy army or conscript army, meaning an army made from ordinary people called up for a specific task. Such armies had serious weaknesses. They were only available at certain times of year, usually not during planting or harvest season. The men had little training and less discipline. They could not be used for long campaigns far from home. Tiglath-Pileser changed all of this. He created an army of full-time professional soldiers. These men were paid a regular wage by the state. They were fed, equipped, and housed by the state. They trained constantly, not just when war was coming. Because they were paid professionals, they could campaign at any time of year, in any weather, in any country. Think of the difference between a weekend football team of office workers who play once a month and a professional football team that trains every day. The gap in skill, fitness, and coordination is enormous. Tiglath-Pileser created the ancient world's equivalent of that professional team, and it showed in every battle they fought. This reform was recorded in Tiglath-Pileser's own royal inscriptions, texts carved into stone in his palaces at a city called Nimrud. These inscriptions, known as the Annals of Tiglath-Pileser Roman III, list the conquered peoples and territories that his new army enabled him to subdue. They are some of the most important historical documents we have from this period. Now let us talk about the weapons and technology that made this professional army so deadly. Here we encounter one of the most important material changes in all of ancient history, the shift from bronze to iron. For thousands of years before the Assyrians, the dominant metal for weapons and tools was bronze. Bronze is an alloy, meaning a mixture of two metals, copper and tin. Bronze weapons were strong, sharp, and deadly. But bronze had a problem. Making it required two different metals, and those metals were not always found in the same place. Copper had to be sourced from one region, tin from another, often very distant. This made bronze expensive and limited how many weapons you could make. Iron changed everything. Iron ore, the raw material for iron, is one of the most common substances on Earth. It exists almost everywhere in large quantities. Once you learn to smelt it properly, meaning to heat it at very high temperatures to extract the pure metal, you can produce iron weapons in much greater numbers at much lower cost. Iron is also harder and tougher than bronze. An iron sword holds its edge better and can take more punishment in battle. The Hittites, a people who lived in what is now Turkey, were among the first to develop iron smelting. But the Assyrians were the first to fully understand the military potential of this new metal and to equip an entire large-scale army with iron weapons. Iron swords, iron-tipped spears, iron helmets, iron arrow tips. When an Assyrian army faced an enemy still using bronze weapons, it was a bit like putting a modern steel knife against a knife made of soft clay. The advantage was enormous. This iron-equipped professional army could defeat most opponents in open battle. But the ancient world had a very effective defense against invading armies, the walled city. Almost every important city in Mesopotamia and the surrounding regions was surrounded by thick stone or mud brick walls. A well-built wall could stop an army for months or even years. The defenders had food, water, and shelter. The attackers were outside in the sun, running low on supplies, far from home. Many ancient empires had been stopped dead by strong city walls. The Assyrians refused to accept this limitation. They invested enormous energy and creativity into what we call siege warfare, meaning the art of attacking and capturing a fortified city. Their methods were so sophisticated and so effective that they essentially turned the ancient world's greatest defense into something that could be overcome within days. Let us walk through their main techniques. The first was the siege tower. Imagine a massive wooden structure, several stories tall, something like a very crude ancient skyscraper on wheels. Assyrian engineers would construct these towers behind the battle lines, out of reach of enemy arrows. Then soldiers would push them slowly toward the city walls. The towers were covered in wet leather hides, which prevented fire arrows from setting them alight. When a tower reached the wall, Assyrian archers on the upper floors could shoot down at the defenders on the wall below, a critical advantage because shooting downward is easier and more accurate than shooting upward. Meanwhile, soldiers on lower levels could attempt to climb directly onto the wall itself. The second technique was the battering ram. A battering ram is a large, heavy beam of wood with a metal cap on one end, designed to be swung repeatedly against a gate or wall until the structure cracks and breaks. The Assyrians developed very powerful versions of these machines. To protect the men operating the ram, they built armored housing around it, essentially a shed on wheels that could move with the ram. The metal cap was often shaped like an animal head, sometimes a lion or a ram, which was both symbolic and functional, as the curved shape helped concentrate the force of the blow. Third was a technique called sapping or mining. Assyrian military engineers, who were highly trained specialists, would dig tunnels under a city's walls. This was dangerous, slow work, but when done correctly, the tunnel would remove the foundation supporting a section of wall. With nothing holding it up from below, that section of wall would crack and collapse, creating a gap that soldiers could rush through. This technique was called undermining the wall, and that word undermining has come down to us in English today as a way of describing any action that secretly weakens something from beneath. Fourth, for cities built on high ground, the Assyrians built earthen ramps. Soldiers, prisoners and enslaved people would carry enormous quantities of earth, packing it against a city's outer defenses to create a sloped road going up to the wall level. Once the ramp was high enough, siege towers and battering rams could be rolled up it to attack the wall at its highest and most defended point. We know these techniques in extraordinary visual detail because of a remarkable set of carved stone pictures discovered in the ancient Assyrian city of Nineveh, the palace of King Sennacherib, who ruled from 705 to 681 BCE, contained walls covered in detailed stone carvings called reliefs. These reliefs are like a giant ancient photograph album of Assyrian military campaigns. The most famous of these carvings shows the Assyrian siege of a city called Lachish in 701 BCE. Lachish was a major fortified city in the Kingdom of Judah, which corresponds roughly to the southern part of modern Israel and the Palestinian territories. The carvings show every stage of the siege in sequence, the earthen ramp being built, the siege towers being rolled up the ramp, archers shooting from the towers, battering rams pounding the walls, soldiers storming through the breach, and finally the defeated inhabitants being marched away into captivity. It is one of the most vivid and complete pictures of ancient warfare that survives anywhere in the world. But the Assyrians were not just a collection of impressive machines. What made them truly formidable was the way they combined different types of fighting forces into one coordinated whole. Historians call this a combined arms approach, meaning an army that uses different kinds of soldiers together in a planned and coordinated way, each type supporting and complementing the others. The Assyrian army had four main types of fighting units. Chariots were wheeled vehicles pulled by horses, carrying a driver and one or two warriors. Earlier armies had used light chariots mainly for speed and archery. The Assyrians developed heavier chariots that were used for shock tactics, meaning charging into enemy lines to break them apart, and also as mobile command platforms from which officers could see and direct the battle. Cavalry means soldiers fighting on horseback. This seems obvious to us today, but in the ancient world it was not. Riding a horse skillfully while also fighting is genuinely difficult, and the techniques had to be invented and refined over generations. Early Assyrian cavalry worked in pairs. One rider controlled the horse while the other fired arrows. This was because the rider controlling the horse needed both hands on the reins and could not also hold a bow. Over time, as training improved, Assyrian cavalrymen learned to control their horses using their knees and body weight alone, freeing both hands to use weapons. This created a highly mobile force that could move quickly across the battlefield, outflank enemies who were moving on foot, and pursue retreating soldiers, preventing them from escaping and regrouping. The infantry, meaning soldiers fighting on foot, formed the core of the army. Assyrian infantry included spearmen who engaged the enemy in close combat, and archers who fired arrows at enemies from a distance. These two groups worked together in a deliberate pattern. Archers would fire volleys of arrows at the enemy, forcing them to crouch behind shields and reducing their ability to fight back effectively. This is sometimes called suppressing fire, keeping the enemy's heads down. While the enemy was suppressed, the spearmen would advance to close the distance and engage in direct combat. The fourth element was the specialists. These were engineers who built siege equipment, logistics experts who planned the movement of food and supplies over long distances, and intelligence agents, people whose job was to gather information about enemy cities, how high their walls were, where their water supply was, who among the city's leaders might be willing to negotiate or betray their own side. The combination of all these elements, chariot shock forces, mobile cavalry, disciplined infantry, and specialist support, made the Assyrian army a far more flexible and capable instrument than any previous fighting force in the region. They could attack from multiple directions simultaneously, switch between different methods of attack depending on the terrain and the enemy, and sustain campaigns for much longer than their opponents could resist. Yet there is one more dimension to Assyrian military power that is perhaps the most disturbing and, in a cold strategic sense, the most clever. This is what we would today call psychological warfare, meaning actions designed not to kill the enemy physically, but to break their will to resist. The Assyrians were masters of fear as a weapon. Their strategy worked like this. Before a campaign even began, they wanted the cities in their path to already be terrified. They wanted gates to open and kings to surrender without any fighting at all. Every city that surrendered peacefully meant Assyrian soldiers did not die, supplies were not used up, and time was saved to move on to the next target. So the Assyrians made sure that their reputation for violence against those who resisted was so extreme, so well known, and so graphically documented that the very sight of their army approaching would make defenders lose courage. Their royal inscriptions and palace carvings were part of this strategy. When Assyrian kings wrote about their own campaigns, they described in vivid detail the punishments inflicted on those who dared to resist. Walls demolished, cities burned, populations enslaved, rebel leaders executed in elaborately painful ways. These were not private documents. They were displayed prominently in palaces where foreign ambassadors and representatives of subject kingdoms would visit. They were meant to be read, to be seen, to be reported back home. They said, in essence, "This is what happens to those who fight us. Is that what you want?" This raises a fascinating question that historians still debate. Why would a powerful state choose to publicly celebrate and document its own cruelty? In many modern political systems, governments try to hide or deny their worst actions. The Assyrians did the exact opposite. The answer seems to be that they understood something very clearly. In a world without instant communication, without newspapers or the internet, reputation was itself a form of power. A terrible reputation, carefully maintained and widely advertised, could cause cities to surrender without a battle ever being fought. The cost of maintaining that reputation, the deliberate cruelty, was, in their calculation, less than the cost of fighting every city individually. The most systematic and chilling expression of this policy was the practice of mass deportation. Deportation means forcibly removing a large group of people from their homeland and relocating them somewhere else, far away. The Assyrians did this on a massive scale. When they conquered a region, they would often remove a substantial portion of the population, sometimes tens of thousands of people, and march them to a completely different part of the empire, sometimes thousands of kilometers away. Other people from other conquered regions would then be brought in to live on the emptied land. This policy served several purposes simultaneously. People removed from their homeland, from their families, their temples, their language communities, were disoriented, traumatized, and far less likely to organize a rebellion. They did not know the new land they were placed in, did not have local allies, did not have the shared identity needed to rise up together. Meanwhile, the emptied land, repopulated with strangers from elsewhere, lacked the shared history and connections that make communities capable of collective resistance. The human cost of this policy was staggering. Historians estimate that over a period of about 250 years, the Assyrians forcibly relocated more than 4 million people. 4 million. To appreciate how large that number is for the ancient world, Consider that the entire population of ancient Mesopotamia was probably only a few million people in total. One of the most historically significant cases of Assyrian deportation involved the Kingdom of Israel in the late 8th century BCE. Israel was a small kingdom in the region we now call the Holy Land. In 722 BCE, the Assyrian king Sargon Roman II, who ruled from 722 to 705 BCE, conquered the northern part of Israel and, according to his own royal inscriptions, deported more than 27,000 Israelites, redistributing them throughout the empire and settling other peoples in their place. The 10 northern tribes of Israel who were deported in this way disappear from historical records. We have no clear evidence of where they went or what happened to them. Historians and religious scholars have debated this mystery ever since. They are known today as the 10 Lost Tribes of Israel, one of the most enduring puzzles of ancient history. The Assyrian Empire was not only held together by military force and fear, it also had a sophisticated administrative system, meaning a structured way of managing and governing large territories from a central point. Think of it like a company with offices in many different countries. Each local office needs a manager, and all those managers need to report to headquarters. The Assyrians divided their empire into provinces. Each province had a governor, an official appointed directly by the king, who was responsible for collecting taxes, maintaining order, raising local troops when needed, and reporting any problems back to the capital. This was not unique to Assyria, but the Assyrians developed it to a very high level of efficiency. They also built a network of roads to connect the empire. These roads, called the King's Roads, allowed messengers on horseback to travel rapidly from the furthest edges of the empire back to the capital. A system of relay stations, a bit like the changing of horses at post stations in much later European history, meant that fresh horses were always available, allowing messages to cover enormous distances in a matter of days. This was crucial for an empire that stretched thousands of kilometers. A rebellion in Egypt or a threat from Persia needed to be known about in Nimrud or Nineveh as quickly as possible. Conquered territories that were not fully absorbed as provinces were sometimes left as vassal kingdoms. A vassal kingdom is a state that keeps its own king and its own internal government but is forced to recognize the Assyrian king as its overlord, to pay tribute regularly, and to provide soldiers for Assyrian campaigns when required. Tribute means regular payments of wealth, gold, silver, horses, timber, grain, fine cloth, anything valuable. This constant flow of tribute from dozens of conquered and vassal states made Assyria extraordinarily wealthy, and that wealth funded the army, the building projects, and the administration of the empire, which in turn enabled more conquest, which brought in more tribute. It was a self-perpetuating cycle, meaning each part fed the others and kept the whole system growing. Now, having spent time admiring the terrible efficiency of this empire, we should pause and ask a question that historians genuinely debate. Were the Assyrians really as original as they are often portrayed? Some scholars argue that many of the military techniques credited to the Assyrians were actually developed or at least begun by earlier peoples. The Hittites, a great empire that dominated Anatolia, which is modern Turkey, before the Assyrians rose to power, had iron working. Earlier Mesopotamian states had used siege techniques and deportations. The Mitannians, another important ancient Near Eastern power, were pioneers of chariot warfare. The debate is not whether the Assyrians were skilled. They clearly were. The debate is whether they were true inventors or whether they were brilliant at taking existing ideas, refining them, combining them, and applying them on a much larger scale than anyone before. This is actually an important distinction in the history of technology and power. Many of the most transformative moments in history have come not from someone inventing something entirely new, but from someone finding a way to combine and apply existing ideas with unusual ambition and efficiency. The Assyrians may be an early and spectacular example of this. There is another debate about what really drove Assyrian expansion. The official reason, stated repeatedly in Assyrian royal texts, was religious. The Assyrian king presented himself as the earthly representative of Ashur, the chief god of the Assyrian people. Asher was a warrior god, and his divine will supposedly required the king to conquer and subjugate all other peoples. In this telling, Assyrian expansion was a sacred duty, the fulfillment of divine command. But historians are skeptical of taking official royal propaganda entirely at face value. Many scholars argue that the real drivers of expansion were economic. Trade routes need to be controlled. Raw materials like timber, metals, and horses exist only in certain places and need to be secured. Agricultural land is limited in the Assyrian heartland. Each of these practical pressures creates incentives for expansion that have nothing to do with religion. The question is whether the religious language was a genuine expression of Assyrian belief or a convenient justification for expansion that would have happened anyway for economic reasons. Most historians today think the answer is probably both. Genuine religious belief and practical economic interests reinforcing each other. Finally, we should consider what may be the most dramatic and instructive part of the whole Assyrian story, their collapse. After centuries of seemingly unstoppable power, the Assyrian Empire fell with shocking speed. In less than 20 years, between roughly 630 and 609 BCE, the whole structure collapsed. The capital cities of Nineveh and Nimrud were sacked and destroyed. The Assyrian royal line came to an end. The empire that had terrified the ancient world for 300 years simply ceased to exist. How does something so powerful collapse so completely? Historians have suggested several answers, and the most likely explanation involves several factors working together. One was imperial overstretch. This term means that an empire has expanded so far and so fast that it can no longer effectively defend all its territories simultaneously. The Assyrian Empire at its peak stretched from Iran to Egypt. Keeping order in such a vast area required enormous resources and constant military presence. As the empire grew, the demands on the army and the treasury grew with it, eventually surpassing what the Assyrian state could sustain. A second factor was internal division. In the last decades of the empire, there were serious power struggles within the Assyrian royal family and among its senior officials. Civil wars and disputes about who should be king weakened the state at exactly the moment when it needed to be strongest. A third factor was the resentment and hatred that Assyrian methods had created across the ancient world. When a coalition of Babylonians, the people of the great southern Mesopotamian city of Babylon, and Medes, a powerful Iranian people, joined forces to attack Assyria, many of the peoples who had been conquered, deported, and brutalized over centuries either joined the attack or simply did nothing to help defend their Assyrian overlords. An empire built primarily on fear has a fundamental weakness. Fear does not create loyalty. The moment the feared power shows signs of weakness, all the suppressed anger and resentment of centuries can surge back with tremendous force. Perhaps there is a lesson in that, one that stretches far beyond the ancient world. Empires built on pure force and terror can be extraordinarily effective for a time. But force without genuine consent, without some degree of willing cooperation from the people being governed, is ultimately fragile. When the force weakens, even slightly, everything it was holding in place can suddenly come apart. Let us gather together the key ideas from this lesson. The Assyrian Empire, particularly in its Neo-Assyrian phase from 934 to 609 BCE, became the most powerful state in the ancient world through a combination of military innovation and political organization. King Tiglath-Pileser Roman III created the world's first known professional standing army, a permanently employed force that trained constantly and could campaign year-round. The Assyrian military was equipped with iron weapons, which were harder and more widely available than the bronze weapons used by most of their enemies. They developed sophisticated siege warfare techniques, including movable towers, powerful battering rams, undermining tunnels, and earthen ramps, which allowed them to overcome the walled cities that had previously halted other armies. Their forces combined chariots, cavalry, infantry, and specialist engineers into a coordinated fighting system more flexible than anything their opponents could field. Beyond physical force, the Assyrians used deliberate psychological warfare, advertising their own brutality through art and inscriptions to make enemies surrender without fighting, and they practiced mass deportation of conquered peoples to break local identities and prevent rebellion. The empire was held together by a network of governors, roads, and tribute payments. Historians debate whether the Assyrians were true military innovators or brilliant synthesizers of existing ideas, whether their expansion was driven by religion or economics, and why such a powerful empire collapsed so completely and quickly at the end. The most likely answer to that last question is that overextension, internal division, and the deep resentment created by 3 centuries of brutal rule combined to bring the whole structure down with remarkable speed, leaving behind a story that is as much about the limits of power as it is about its possibilities.